Take a network break. Get in on the ground floor of our new virtual donut startup. It's AI-powered, blockchain-certified, and 100% buzzword-compliant. I'm Drew Conry Murray. Greg Farrow is dialing in, still from Silicon Valley. You've been there for a long time.
Yeah, I was here for Network Field Day last week with the Gestalt ID team. Talked a little bit about what I learned from there. We went to the traditional IT vendors, you know, your favorites, A10 Networks, Big Switch, and Red Hat. We got a presentation from Ansible. So all very, you know, traditional IT vendors. And this week, I was a guest of Google Next. Full disclosure, Google did actually invite me as part of their community program and paid for my flights and accommodation. But I was, you know, obviously free to say whatever I like.
And we're going to put that to the test in just a minute.
It's been a really interesting event. Like, the difference between enterprise IT and cloud is not as wide as it used to be. And I think we'll talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, we will get right into that. But first, just a couple of quick business points. Today's show is being sponsored in part by Interoptic. They offer high performance, high quality optics at a fraction of the cost. And you can find out more at interoptic.com. And of course, the Packet Pushers have launched Ignition. This is our brand new membership site. It's at ignition.packetpushers.net, and it has free and paid membership options. All right, to the news. You are at Google, their next show, and the big news seems like it's this Google Cloud Services platform. It's a bundle of services and capabilities so that you can create a unified development and operations environment to write applications once, so you can run them on premises, in the cloud, or some kind of hybrid magic.
Yeah, so I think there's two big announcements, maybe three, that we're going to get into today. But the first one is Cloud Services Platform, which is effectively their managed network in the cloud. So Google networking has sort of been not hugely useful, if I can say that.
You just did.
Yeah, and there was not a lot of visibility. It was hard to work with. We didn't know what was happening. And one of the things that they tried to present during the sessions, not so much during the keynote, was that they've been talking to customers and specifically about the enterprise. Now, you might remember they hired Diane Greene a couple of years back to run the enterprise part of Google Cloud and to get out there and make it appealing to the enterprise.
And she came from VMware, right? Was that?
She was originally the founder of VMware, and she did leave some years ago to go into venture capital. So to get her back is quite a thing. But the general sort of belief is that she's got special magic powers around enterprise IT. And I'd say so far that's bearing out. Now, whether that's because of her particularly or whether it's because the company's just decided, you know, Google has decided that attaching to the enterprise is good business, whatever. But Istio is a really key part of it. Now, Istio is a sidecar proxy, or was really part of an Envoy proxy. And what Google has done is put their programmers and resources into the project and then adopted it into their cloud environment. Istio is a layer 7 proxy that sits in the traffic flow. So what it does is, because it's in between all the flows, you can now start to map everything that's happening in your cloud. One of the problems in the cloud is that if you have 100, you know, containers running microservices, you might quickly lose control of which container is talking to which container, and you have no idea what the visibility is. So this Istio service mesh has become a core activity as a way of saying to giving customers a sense of control, especially infrastructure professionals like us who are expected to design and control the DevOps and keep them, you know, on the straight and narrow.
I like to think of it as, you know, Kubernetes is an orchestration system for running your containers. It seems like Istio is a service mesh or orchestration system for running connections between containers and services.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, the point is that VLANs and IP subnets were actually a control point. We were able to group things in VLANs.
Yeah.
And we could identify the flows, and therefore, and if we needed to, we could go inside those flows and capture them. People have spam ports and packet capture engines for quite a long time now. But in the cloud, that becomes pointless because containers are ephemeral. They might only last for minutes. They could be anywhere in the cloud, you know, and obviously giving access to the physical infrastructure is impossible. It's just not secure. It wouldn't be safe. So this Istio is the reaction to this. Now, I went to a number of networking sessions about this, and it's actually not just connectivity. It's actually just plain about the visibility. Obviously, Google's been able to connect containers in for ages, but what they're actually saying is, it's about visibility. And what they're actually doing with the Istio is they're using the data streaming off these things like flow logs and the visibility actions that are inside them to build up maps of your service and show you where it is. So for the first time, I really felt I had a sense of what was visible in the cloud. Like when I have, and I'm not an AWS professional, I don't claim to be experienced, but in AWS, I never had this sense that I was in control of what the infrastructure looked like. Sure, you can make VPCs and you can build, you know, systems of VPCs to control data and have folders and containers. But GCP is actually building visual tools to make it easy for ordinary people to onboard.
it's bringing that management, that monitoring down into the container and service level. So you have a sense of who's talking to what, how, when, and what the performance is like, yes?
Yeah, I guess the way we think as enterprise people is we have a sense of packets flow down this from here to here, and we know what that is. When you put it in the cloud, you lose that sense of where data is going to and from. So that's what I felt that they're addressing, is that lack of what's happening. And not only are they putting in the service proxies, they're also building on a bunch of tools on top of that. So the service proxies can then send their data into tools like Stackdriver or BigQuery, so you can then query the data. So you don't have to go and install extra tools to get the visibility that you want. You can just use the tools. They're not networking-centric tools, but they demoed a couple of alpha products in the sessions on Thursday, on the last day, that very few people attended, which is kind of sad, showing how you could actually take logs off these things and start to see. So things like, for example, flow logs coming off the VPC can be used to start identifying where the BGP ASNs are. So where did the traffic come from? How much traffic's coming from America and all that sort of stuff? These are tools that are normally in enterprise, things that you have to go out and buy and deploy, and then it takes months to get them up to speed and operating. Whereas in Google Cloud, you just say, export all the flow logs into that, run this query, boom. You suddenly got the breakup, your global breakup of traffic hitting your website.
That's right. Now, to tie this all back to what's going on at Google, they and others have developed Istio, which is an open source project to do all this. It's a service mesh. But now they've announced managed Istio, which is what it sounds like, a managed version of the Istio service mesh platform that you can run in the cloud or on premises. Is that's what's happening, right?
Well, they're throwing resources at the Istio project. So originally it was Envoy, which was done by Lisp and a couple of other people. And then it's now been turned into a project called Istio. And then Google has effectively weaponized it into a product.
Like Kubernetes, yes.
Yeah, well, Kubernetes came out of Google. So Google, right. Kubernetes was the version.
That's true. Google, yeah, Kubernetes originated in Google, where this sounds like Google glommed onto an existing project, yeah.
Yeah, and Lyft, where the original idea behind Envoy came from, was having troubles with exactly what I was talking about, the visibility into the data. They couldn't measure the performance of API calls because they couldn't get into the network to see the data. And they didn't know where the data was going. So, you know, they would find all of a sudden that this microservice is talking to 10 other microservices, some of which they didn't even know about. So, you know, there's all these different issues in cloud visibility that you haven't got. So a big theme for the whole Google event was this, in networking in particular. I managed to get to 8 sessions on networking, and there was about 16 or 18 of them. And wow. The big theme was this visibility and analytics, just talking about how security and networking works in the Google platforms.
So as usual, networking is sort of being dragged along behind all of the other cloud developments, but it's happening, at least in the Google Cloud side.
I would take it a step further, and I would say that Google's recognized that networking is a key weakness, and somewhere along the line, they've rotated onto that with Istio. And if I was more importantly, I think more than anything, was they're speaking enterprise language. Mm-hmm. Like when you read AWS stuff in the documentation or Azure, they just have this whole other language that just isn't approachable. You have to, part of getting onto their clouds is that you have to learn their language. You have to think like they think. You can't bring any of your enterprise stuff. You have to throw all that away and start again. They try and pretend that that's needed because you have to cloudify, right? And what Google's showing me is that you don't.
You can talk a language that your audience is going to understand, yeah.
Yes, that's exactly right. Well, it's not perfect. Like, that's an imperfect metaphor. But when they have something that's a firewall, they call it a firewall. And when there's a firewall rule, it's called an ACL. You know,
okay, right.
When they eject flow logs, they call them flow logs.
So they're not making you do that sort of context switch of, okay, when you say this, you mean firewall.
Yeah, which makes it very hard to onboard into Azure and AWS. They sort of say, you know, we're so awesome, you have to come to us. You know, it's up to you to come to us. It's not up to us to come to you. Whereas Google, I think, is very much, because it's running third, you know, and likely because it's losing, is becoming a little humbler, shall we say?
Yes. Yeah. I can see that. Yes. Essentially, it's also maybe a strategic choice to say, let's, you know, use language that this audience is familiar with to help them bring this on board.
Yeah. So I'm hoping to do a bit of a YouTube video on this. And I'm also thinking I'll publish a couple of sessions, which I'll put a blog post out in the next week or two points to the sessions that I went to, which would be good viewing. I don't think I'll have the time available to extract the relevant bits. I was hoping to make a video where I could download the videos and suck out the bits that I thought were really relevant, but I don't think I'll have time. It just takes a long time to edit video because I'm traveling and we're migrating the website next week. So it'll be a little while before I get up to that. Maybe I will, maybe I won't.
Okay. In the meantime, we'll have links to Google about managed Istio, which we should also mention. It's still an alpha project. It's not shipping yet, but if you want to get in on the ground floor, we'll have links where you can take a look. Some more Google news. It wouldn't be a Google event without talking about Kubernetes. And now Google has announced GKE on-prem. That's Google Kubernetes Engine on-prem. There's those magic words, on-prem.
Yeah. So the first thing to note about this announcement was it was on the first day. It wasn't on the second day or the third day.
So
right?
that means they're giving it a high priority.
Yeah, if you apply your conference keynote foo.
Yes, so what's the meta-analysis?
Yeah, so the idea here is that we've seen Azure produce Azure Stack as a way to gateway onto the cloud. What Google is doing here is quite different. What they're actually doing is saying, we recognize that most of our customers are going to be on-prem at some level. So what we want to do is bring our tools so you can have them on-prem. And we don't care whether you run them on-prem or off-prem, that's entirely, you know, or whether you run multiple regions in the cloud or run multiple regions in your prem data centers, whatever you like. Here's a version of our cloud, Google Kubernetes Engine, GKE, and you can run it on-prem. Boom. That's the whole thing. So you get containers, you get your Istio, you get the cloud control plane. So you still have all of the Google stuff in the cloud. And when you log in, you hit your IAM, your security features, the key, all of the control systems that Google has built in its public cloud, it then reaches down and applies to the Google's Kubernetes engine that you have on-prem. This is really quite a good idea, I think.
And the idea is that if I'm a developer, I write the application and I can have it be wherever I want it, whether private, public, or hybrid. Capture the developers, give them an environment they're familiar with, and then the organization can decide whether they want that application to be in the cloud or on-premises.
That's right. Or maybe you want to have the take away the latency, or maybe you've got data restrictions where you have to keep the data in a country or inside your four walls. And you might be able to come up with a way to say, well, it's managed by Google, but the data is still on-prem. You know, or maybe you need to have the compute workloads local for speed. You know, if you're going to have very fast iterative cycles, you need to have very low latency if you're monitoring a factory. So obviously, this is a very good solution for hyper-converged infrastructure. That is, you know, go and build at a pre-approved rack so that Google can make sure the hardware is exactly what they expect it to be and that there's no hardware and software incompatibility issues. You would think that, you know, after 20 years of x86, we wouldn't have any compatibility issues, but apparently there's enough so-called innovation in this server space. Anyway, so I was very surprised to see Cisco trundle out on stage and very quickly talk about they have hardware solution, and we'll be piloting that with Google for the next 6 months. So if you're interested in this, Cisco will be the only company supplying the hyperconverged infrastructure for GKE to run on-prem. They've got a bit of a leadership there.
And this sort of ties back to this partnership that we've seen Cisco and Google developing. Cisco made a big deal of it at Cisco Live this year, and I guess Google gave them a little keynote stage time.
A little. I think it might have been 15 seconds, maybe 30.
It really wasn't.
Yeah. It was notable because I actually turned to the person next to me and said, was that just Cisco on stage? Because I was actually looking at my phone. And he said, yeah.
Did I blink and miss the Cisco part?
Because I literally was looking down and I was just setting up a meeting with somebody and it's looked at, what?
Missed it?
So it was really short. I do feel that someone promised... You know, you just get the feeling sometimes that somebody promised somebody that they'd be on stage and then they went, oh, I wish we hadn't have done that. So anyway, but it is worth pointing that in the blog post that accompanies this, it says Cisco is in their blog post to publicize this, Cisco is at pains to highlight Chuck Robbins and Diane Greene prioritize extraordinary effort. I don't know why it would be extraordinary, but anyway, to develop and execute our goals. I'm not sure what that sentence actually means when I try to decode that. There's no foo I can apply to that. But it does seem that Cisco wants to suggest that it's got special relationships with Google, and this is logically the extension of that. And they're going to be able to sell some UCS chassis on the back of this, which is nice for them. What is notable is, as far as I can tell, there's no Cisco networking in here. There's no ACI. There's no, you know, Cisco may do that in the stack itself, but that's not, Google's not going to orchestrate all of that. And I doubt that it's even needed. Google's got all the networking it needs. And it doesn't, I don't think it's going to be using any of the features, like the magic source features that Cisco likes to offer to customers.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
But I guess that also makes sense, because if Google is really starting to pursue the enterprise, then Cisco is definitely an enterprise stalwart. And so that's a good partnership to have.
Yeah. Well, it'll be like Azure Stack. Dell got to market first with Azure Stack. They got a 12-month window to go and, you know, rub up against customers and see which ones, you know, were attracted to the idea of buying Azure Stack.
Yeah, start doing some evangelization. And
that's right. And then HP was approved, and then finally Cisco was approved. So, you know, Cisco's made a deal with Google, and that's the one it's going to follow down. VMware, of course, is in bed with AWS, with VMware on AWS. And, you know, we talked about the AWS switching thing last week.
With Big Switch essentially building VPCs on premises, yeah.
Yeah, same sort of thing going on here is one. So, you know, what Big Switch, the idea that Big Switch had to bring VPCs on-prem, Google is definitely doing here.
Yeah, right.
But what we're also seeing is, if you go back further where we talked about AWS was going to announce its own switch and everybody got in a kerfuffle and Cisco's share price fell 5%, et cetera, et cetera. I bet AWS is doing something like this too. In somebody got the story wrong and it's an on-prem thing for the edge, like what this is.
Yeah, probably, yeah. But AWS building a white box switch to sell to enterprises doesn't make as much sense. But anyway, we already talked about that. All right, so a couple more Google stories before we move on. Let's see, we've talked a lot about edge computing recently. Last week, I think we mentioned AWS and their Snowball edge device. So Google is getting in on the game. The whole idea behind edge computing is that you have some kind of compute infrastructure to do some local collection and processing of data at like an office building or a factory or hospital. So Google's rolling out something called Edge TPU. This is a custom ASIC. It provides machine learning capabilities so you can analyze that local data.
Yeah, that's right. So the idea here is that we know about the edge. We just talked about Google Compute Engine, Google Kubernetes Engine coming to the edge. And, you know, everything is about the edge because what these companies are saying is that our cloud is the perfect place to do the centralized processing and have access to lots and lots of data tools, but we have to collect the data. So we have to find, and that's going to come from the edge. But not everything in the edge is going to be sent back to us for processing. Sometimes we need to make rapid decisions at close to the edge of the network.
Right. Things like predictive maintenance, anomaly detection. If you're working with IoT sensors that are collecting immediate data, you want to have some immediate feedback on that. So yeah, you need some kind of compute infrastructure right there on site.
That's right. So if you're monitoring an engine shaft going around at 10,000 RPMs and something can develop inside of 10 minutes, you know, maybe the shaft starts to bend or the metal fatigues, you need to make an intelligent assessment of a problem and shut it down long before the time you can collect the data, send it up to the cloud, analyze it, and then send it back and go, it's broken.
Guess what? Yeah. That metal's about to shear, and oh boy. Yeah.
And by the time you get the alert back, the machine's, you know, in 1,000 tiny pieces on the ceiling. So this sort of, I mean, these are, I think it's more than just industrial. I think it's very also about consumer. I think we'll start to see these TPUs get into consumer things, especially in the home, where they might be able to start monitoring power and air conditioning and heating and save energy. You know, this chip was very small, but it looks, I bet it could be optimized a lot further to be inside of a smartphone over time. But you usually start off with this and then see how it goes. So it's TensorFlow, so it's artificial intelligence. You can run Google's TensorFlow language on this. Obviously, it's not going to be Google powered, you know, in the big clouds where there's megawatts, so it's got to be, you know, run a bit lighter. But you can actually run inference algorithms at the edge and then get that into your solutions. Obviously, that's years away. It's going to take years for the chips to come and then people to put them in their apps and computers.
Yeah, just to make sure this is clear, like other announcement that we've talked about today, this product is still, it's early access, they're calling it early access phase. You have to actually request access from Google to participate. It's not shipping yet.
But it's real. I did actually meet some Googlers who were willing to pull it out and just show it to me.
It's not smoke and mirrors, but it's also not shipping. Yeah.
No, it's not a PowerPoint announcement. It's not a we're gonna. It's real. It's actually here. And generally, I think I've got no reason to disbelieve Google. They're generally what they say they'll do, they'll do.
Right. They have a very good track record.
Now, they also have a very good track record of throwing things in the bin as well. So, yeah, let's not
They do. So maybe not get too attached to it either.
That's right. I still miss Google Wave. And right. Google Reader. Hello.
All right. This, I believe, is our final Google-related story. As of last week, the latest version of Google's Chrome browser is going to start alerting users when a site is just using HTTP instead of the more secure HTTPS or TLS. Chrome has been warning users in the browser bar, but now it's put in explicit, this site is not secure message right on the main screen. And this is, of course, to encourage website developers and owners to switch to TLS.
All right. So this has been coming for some time now. And if you're into conspiracy theories, you would think that that's because Google wants to keep all the data, because it does. It actually makes sense for Google to make sure that networks like AT&T and Verizon can't steal valuable customer data and then undermine Google's ability to monetize ads. If you're, on the other hand, it is also important for people to trust the network. That is, users must be able to send. I always use the example here that when you posted a love letter to your girlfriend when you were a teenager, you needed to be very confident that no one was going to read that.
Right.
Okay. And because she didn't want to have that out in public. And, you know, well, maybe that was a different era and maybe the kids today are different. But the point is that the network must be trusted. And so getting to TLS, ultimately what we're doing is we're not upgrading to TLS. We're just patching what was a fault. That is, we couldn't do encryption at this level 20 years ago, and now we can. So really, I don't see this as upgrade. I see this as patching what was fundamentally a bug back in the day when, you know, mass corporate surveillance wasn't possible. The flip side of us, of course, is that packet pushers isn't TLS, although it is now. And we are actually migrating our site as we speak. And possibly by the time you download this episode, packet pushers will have been migrated onto a new platform. You should notice it being a lot faster because the current hosting sucks pretty badly. And it'll be fully SSL using Let's Encrypt, and it'll also be available on IPv6.
Yeah. Hey, wow.
Turns out our previous hoster hadn't actually learned how to spell IPv6, and they have no plans. And then just recently we found out that they'd sold themselves to somebody else, so that just drove us off the platform.
So it was time to go.
Time to go. So we're actually moving into self-hosting, which is painful. So if there is anything wrong with the feeds or anything, please tweet at us or email us to packetpushers@gmail.com. That would be very helpful to know if you're having problems, because if something – although I can test the website and why I can test the server side, I can't test the millions of podcatchers out there, which are all quite weird and esoteric. And your RSS, like a lot of people who are using RSS readers, I think most of those that are under maintenance, like being actively maintained by their developers, will continue to work. But all of our RSS feeds will be going to SSL, and it's possible that your RSS reader may not work.
All right. Yeah. So keep that in mind. We are doing a site upgrade. We hope that it goes smoothly. But yeah, if you find issues, let us know and we'll address them as we can. And so to wrap up the section, you just had some general comments about the overall Google Next experience.
This is a wonderful conference. Again, just preface, Google did give me an invitation and has paid for my hotel and my travel, but I wasn't handled. So normally when I go to a conference like this and been invited as a guest of the vendor, they normally give you a handler who makes sure you see all the things that they want you to see.
Yes, you get Sherpa'd around, yes.
Yeah. There was none of that. It was literally come and participate in our conference, which I did. I attended a whole bunch of events. I literally sat down and went through the schedule and then went between all the buildings. First thing, the overall thing was Google speaking a language I understand. I said this at the top of the show, but I want to emphasize this. I sat in networking sessions and did not feel like I was watching a bunch of aliens talk. Really was able to comprehend exactly what they were getting to. And I really felt like they've understood where the enterprise is coming from. Instead of developing their own language, they're just speaking the same languages that I am. That's not to say it's immediately, because there are different principles that the cloud operates in, but it didn't feel like foreign to me. One of the other things I wanted to point out was the diversity of speakers. I think maybe half of the speakers were women, which is great. And also very diverse racial backgrounds as well. So there was all types of different people on stage. Like most speakers, it was obvious that English was a second language. But they'd obviously been coached and validated and made sure that it was all good. The presentation qualities was extremely high. I just wanted to call that out. Although all of the toilets had been made into non-gendered toilets. So, you know, upstairs at the Moscone West, and they normally have the women's toilets and the men's toilets. The men's toilets have a massive queue.
Yes.
And then there's no one in the women's toilets. Well, there was women in the women's toilets, but there's also men, because all the toilets had been switched over to not, you could go into any one.
Okay.
It took me, I had to get used to that. I'll have to say that I'm an old dinosaur, and I'm going to have to work on that.
I like that they're sort of load balancing the available capacity. That makes sense to me. All right, you just close the door. You're all good.
But they did have things like mother's rooms, which I thought was extraordinary. Like in all the venues, there was an area set aside for mother's rooms.
Well, that's good.
So if there was a mother who was nursing, they could go there. I thought that was just, it was a nice touch. You know, these are the things that happen when companies have lots of money. They can afford to, you know, do these things. It reminds me of the vendors of old, you know, when we used to go to Cisco conferences or VMware conferences or Microsoft conferences, and they used to have all these fun things. Oh, and there's snacks everywhere, and there was, you know, lots of coffee. Now when you go to these conferences with the companies that are under pressure to, you know, shrink, they don't put out a lot of coffee and they don't put out snacks, and their food's not so great. The food was really awesome. So, yeah, pretty amazing in that sense. But I imagine that will change in years ahead.
We'll see. It depends on Google's bottom line.
Yeah, that's right. It's always said to do with the bottom line, that, you know, that just how many of the luxuries in these conferences tends to do with how much profitability they're trying to extract from the event.
Well, I will tell you, as in a previous role, I did work on a tech conference, and the hotels or the venue sites will gouge you on food and coffee. That's where their margin is, and they push it. It is pretty stunning. Yeah.
$300 a gallon for coffee. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So. I've heard that number, that sort of number before. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's real. Quick break to tell you about today's sponsor, Interoptic. Demand from the edge. There's that edge again. 5G and IoT are coming. If you're not doing optics correctly, you're going to pay for it later. Interoptic understands you're going to need a more nimble layer zero, and they support the full range of products that you need today and don't yet know you'll need tomorrow. So stop paying OEM prices for optics and start talking to optics experts who deliver brand equivalent transceivers at a fraction of the price. And don't be fooled by lesser optics. The difference between generic, third party, and brand equivalent optics matters. You can purchase the same, if not better performing optics at a fraction of the cost. They're designed by engineers who truly understand what you need. So it's time to take control of your optics purchase with Interoptic. Go to interoptic.com to learn how they can help you spec the right optics for your network. That's interoptic.com, and we thank them for being a sponsor. All right, we got some business news now. Qualcomm is abandoning its proposed $44 billion acquisition of semiconductor company NXP after China declined to approve the merger.
Actually, they didn't decline to approve it, but nor did they approve it.
I see. They put it in a limbo state, and there was no way to move forward.
Yeah, they sort of said, you know, well, and obviously there's a certain amount of politics going here, because if you don't deny the application, you can always stand up and say, we didn't deny the application. And if you don't approve it, you just go silent, then you have met the goals of, you know, the some sort of political goal that you're trying to achieve.
Right. And there was that's because there was a deadline between Qualcomm and NXP to get regulatory approval from, I think, 9 countries, and China was the last hurdle to go over. And so the deadline expired. There was no movement from China, and so the deal had to be called off.
And now Qualcomm has to pay a $2 billion penalty to NXP. So, you know, it is kind of clever for the Chinese to sort of stand back and say, oh, you know, we didn't deny it. We didn't approve it, but we didn't deny it. And so that if Qualcomm ever wants to, you know, if anybody wants to get all shirty with them, they can always change their mind.
Turn into a Schrodinger's cat experiment.
Yeah, that's right. So really, you know, it absolves China from blame if bad things happen that are a direct result of the actions here. So kudos to China for being, you know, pretty smart about this, although Qualcomm now has to pay a $2 billion penalty to NXP, which is pretty grim.
That's heavy.
Yeah, and keep in mind that this would have started before the trade war problems that started up between the US government and the Chinese government. So I imagine that Qualcomm's pretty narked about who's in power in the US right about now, because they've just cost them $2 billion.
Could be.
And what we're actually seeing is in the news this morning as we speak, as I was doing some final research, was that actually, unusually, China is now actually denying blocking the deal. So they're actually defending themselves against the US press, which is saying China blocked the deal, and saying, no, we didn't block it. We just didn't approve it.
Yes. And I saw a story in Reuters with a Chinese authority saying, we're welcome to more discussions. If they want to bring this back to the table, we'll talk about it, even though the deadline has already passed. And a statement from Qualcomm essentially said, yeah, the deal's done. It can't happen.
Well, they can't. They don't feel that regulatory approval will ever happen. So I wonder if Qualcomm is going to go and start buying software companies like Broadcom did. Because, you know, they were going to spend $44 billion to buy NXP, and now they're not. So the question is, have they raised a war chest, and do they have to do something with it? So, and with Apple this week also announced that it won't be using Qualcomm's baseband modems, 4G modems, in the next generation of the iPhone because of lawsuits between Apple and Qualcomm, is also a pretty nasty kick in the face for Qualcomm.
Right. Yeah, and the whole reason they were going after NXP is because it would allow them to diversify into different kinds of chipsets that have different use cases and applications outside of mobile phones.
Mm-hmm. So, they could be in trouble.
Right, or other acquisitions may be pending, so we'll keep an eye on that.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. Gigamon, they have acquired a security startup called Iceberg. Iceberg combines an on-premise sensor. It collects network metadata from switches and routers and then sends that data to the cloud for analysis. So the idea is that customers can then access that data, do threat hunting, do security investigations. The sensors collect the network data from packet brokers such as Gigamon. So in an interview I had with Gigamon about the acquisition, they said they'd actually worked with Iceberg on a few customer deals and decided they liked what they saw.
Put a ring on it. So,
that's,
you know,
right.
Kudos for that. Don't set up partnerships. Put a ring on it. So I like that. One of the things is, remember at the start of the year of 2018, I said there's going to be lots of the two big themes that I, well, there's a couple of big themes, but analytics and visibility was one of them. And that's what this is.
It is, yes. It's definitely an analytics and visibility play.
It is not a threat analysis. It's not a malware hunting. It's not a, it's just a visibility. That is, customers used to buy Gigamon's products just to build a visibility fabric, and then they would have to go and buy other products to extract value from the Gigamon. So they'd go and buy IDSs or Seams or packet capture engines, whatever. Right. And Big Switch came along. I see this as a competitive reaction to what Big Switch Networks has done, because they've built their own visibility fabric and then strapped visibility engines on top of it. So now you can buy a Big Switch fabric and it immediately has value built to you as a visibility fabric, in the same way that Istio was, as we talked at the top of the show, right? You start to see all the packet flows and you can make charts and graphs and do the BGP lookups and source IPs and ASN, you know, the BGP ASN numbers and all that sort of stuff. And I think Gigamon needs to catch up here, and that's what it's doing. It's following the market, not leading it.
That's right. It's saying we're now adding value to the packets that we're brokering because we can actually do something with them instead of just send them to a third-party tool.
Yeah, it's very difficult to sell visibility fabrics because when you buy one, it doesn't do anything.
Right. It just moves the packets to somewhere else, and then you do something with it. Yeah,
that's right. So. And so this is the problem that we're seeing happen with other platform plays like Contrail and ACI, and they don't actually do anything. So until these companies start adding value to them, like visibility and analytics is a really easy win, they're not all that useful, right? So you're going to see more of these sorts of things where networks come with visibility and analytics built in. When you buy SD access, you get, say, Cisco's SD access in the campus, you're going to get that kind of for free. So that's a whole new thing that never used to be. Your network used to be plug it in, you got connected, that's your reward. You know, there's your benefit. That's your benefit is you're connected. That's no longer true. We have to offer more than that. And so this is just obvious. One of the things I did find interesting, I don't know, when you read the blog post, do you think it was a bit short? Like, it didn't say much.
The press release or the blog post? Yeah, it was a little scant on details.
I just felt that there was something missing there. I couldn't quite...
You're not sure what it didn't satisfy your...
Well, Gigamon historically hasn't bought much. So they've typically done it all themselves. And I do wonder if there's just a little discomfort. It's just odd when you see like 200 words when they've just made what I think to be one of the first... They made more words about their number one market share or something.
Of course.
Than they did about acquiring this company.
Well, here's my thinking. So Iceberg's value essentially is that it's a SaaS application, that they're handling all the data storage and normalization and all that for you outside of your infrastructure, which if you're Gigamon, whose goal is to sell infrastructure, may seem like, wait, this isn't quite a fit. But Iceberg also will sell you a hardware sensor to get that data to send up to the cloud. So yep. Maybe this is sort of like a way for Gigamon to get its toe in the water of having products in its portfolio that aren't directly tied to hardware. And so, yes, maybe there is a little bit of discomfort with having this new model that they're bringing into the organization.
Well, Gigamon's got cloud tooling, although via an agent. You have to install an agent into the server to add it to the Gigamon visibility fabric. This is where Istio is a benefit because you don't have to, you know, tools like Istio go, they don't go on the server. They don't add software to the container, right? That's much easier to care for and to administer.
Yeah, yeah.
Still has to be orchestrated into the flow, but, you know, whatever. But I just felt the blog post was like, missing the point. And it was incredibly brief. I didn't feel like they'd actually spelled out what Iceberg, you know, maybe it's nothing. Maybe it's just me and I'm traveling and it's very early in the morning, but there you go.
That could be. All right. Moving on. Slack Technologies, they're buying rival chat platform HipChat from Atlassian for an undisclosed amount. Bloomberg is reporting that the two software companies reached it. Sounds like a friendly deal in which Slack is going to pay out over 3 years to acquire HipChat and Stride, which are two Slack competitors made by Atlassian. And it's because the business chat market has essentially come down to Slack and Microsoft Teams. And so the move gives Slack access to more customers and also allows Atlassian kind of a graceful exit.
Yeah, so chat apps are very interesting. I actually see them as replacing social media for a lot of people. So instead of using Facebook groups to chat to people or Twitter DMs or, you know, Google, whatever it was, a lot of people are moving certain communication into chat apps like Slack. And I think that makes sense. So for a lot of people, I also feel that developers never really took to HipChat. When I played with HipChat a few years back, it was just this really feature-rich environment, but it was unapproachable because the too many features just got in the way. I couldn't make any sense of it. And it was expensive.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was really pricey. Like you know, $30 a month type pricey. You want to have a really good reason for being in HipChat. And so Atlassian acquired HipChat in 2012 and basically 6 years decides it hasn't been able to make a go of it. So they've had plenty of time to try and make it into a Slack competitor, but obviously have just decided to lay down and let it go. What they've actually done, interestingly, is taken a stake in Slack. So part of, you know, giving all of HipChat to Slack and the IP and the customers and giving them a transition, so that is all the HipChat customers will migrate to Slack nominally, they've actually paid Slack to buy into the company as part of the deal, which is interesting, right?
Yeah,
unusual sort of a deal. In that sense, most people are sort of slagging it. I think Microsoft Teams is the major competitor. Cisco, of course, has its own one that I haven't seen a whole lot of traction. Although at the Google Next conference on one of the keynotes, Google announced that Cisco was going to be integrating with G Suite. It was just an announcement that flew by. There's a blog post on Cisco's website talking about Cisco collaboration getting into the G Suite, like in Google Docs and Google Spreadsheets. And you can, in the calendar, you can book a meeting and it'll instantly integrate with a WebEx.
Yeah,
my least favorite web conferencing platform, I'm sorry. So, you know, there are steps going forward there to try and make Cisco's collaborations offering more attractive to people. Google did have a big push around G Suite. I didn't talk about that because I didn't think that was very relevant to our audience. But if you're interested, go and check it out.
All right, and just a quick break to remind you that we've launched our new membership site. It's Ignition. You can find it at ignition.packetpushers.net. We have free and paid membership tiers, and it's our site for content meant to drive your professional development.
Yeah, Ignition really is a place where, A, you can support us. So lots of people have asked us over the years, can we give you some financial support, make donations, or, you know, support you on Patreon? What we've decided to do is to really like build this into a site for professional development and give you information. So today we've built the site. We're asking you to, you know, sign up and become a member and just support us in that way. And then what we're now doing is working hard on bringing you content. So this week I published an ebook. It's in four parts on career advice. So I've effectively looked back over all the shows that we've published over the last 8 years and then sat down and thought about career advice that I've given to people. And then collected it into 20,000 words, which is a fairly substantial ebook, and put it out there. So it's advice on handling modern recruitment, how to handle interviews, advice on questions to ask at interviews, and challenging you to think about your career. So if you're sitting there evaluating yourself and saying, what is it about me that makes me valuable to my employer? How to ask for a pay rise? How to have confidence to ask for a pay rise? You know? You deserve it, sort of stuff. It does get a bit wishy-washy in play. It's an unusual book. I don't apologize for that because it just reflects my thoughts. So it's there. It's been fairly well reviewed by the people who did the reviews for me. They actually said, I wish I had read this 10 years ago. So maybe it's the right idea for you. So you could sign up for integration and download that book for free. And I'll be continuing, you know, as the membership system progresses, I'll continue to add to that book. So my plan is about once every 3 months to come back and refresh it and perhaps to add a bit more content to it and make it grow over time. We have a range of other professional development plans coming too. We want to do presentations about a whole bunch of stuff. So, but that's just going to take time.
Right. We plan to have courses and things on there. Right now there's videos, there's some blogs, there's a white paper. So there is content there. So go check it out. And also, of course, that's where we're putting link propagation and human infrastructure, our two newsletters.
Exactly. All that extra content that we have available is there. And we are getting down the pipeline of commissioning other people to write content. So it's not just us. We are actually paying people to generate high quality content that would be relevant to the audience, to you.
Yeah. So ignition.packetpushers.net, go check it out. All right, we'll wrap up with a little bit of news on from the financial sector. Juniper Networks, they reported their second quarter 2018 financial results. They had revenues of $1.2 billion, which is down 8% year over year. They also had net income of $116 million, which is down 35% year over year.
Yeah, so it doesn't sound very good, but it did actually meet what the market was expecting. So these drops in sales and revenue have already been priced in. George Notta from Jefferies says, this quarter's results and guidance underscores the lumpiness and volatility inherent in the business. Moreover, the black box nature of their cloud customers make it difficult to predict the trajectory of the business. Longer term, we still view the stock as a play on the architectural technology changes going on in cloud provider accounts. We're keeping our hold rating. So, you know, cloud revenues decreased 4% sequentially, but 26% year over year. In other words, the big cloud companies slow down their spending. In practical purposes, Juniper is transitioning away from the MX to the PTX. And so a lot of cloud companies will be waiting you know, still ready to spend on that sort of thing. And as well, at the same time, some cloud companies are moving away from Juniper to their own in-house gear. So it seems likely that this is why, as I've said before, I think you'll see many more of these companies return to the enterprise, because it's a stabler, more predictable business. And the cloud companies continue to move in a different direction to the products that come from the traditional vendors. In other words, the big cloud companies have outgrown, you know, what most IT vendors can produce and have moved into their own paths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've definitely seen Juniper make moves to sort of go back to the enterprise and try to win them over again. Yeah.
Yeah. We saw, we talked about the Contrail in the campus. We've seen Contrail extended into multi-cloud, you know, in various presentations. They've got plans. They're executing on them. Clearly, they've done all right. The share price didn't fall anything, you know, nothing amazing happened like what Facebook did this week. Facebook, of course, right. They announced basically a drop in active users. In other words, people have stopped engaging with their product and their share price fell 20%. Why? Because there's no growth for Facebook. So basically the business was priced on the presumption that there'd be more people and therefore more revenues in the future. And all of a sudden we're starting to see that thesis fail and there is no future for Facebook. And so I expect Facebook to suffer substantially. And I would say most likely Facebook's business is going to be damaged fairly heavily and they're going to shrink substantially in the weeks ahead.
We shall see what happens. Intel also announced their second quarter 2018 financial results. They brought in $17 billion in revenue, which is up 15% year over year with net income of $5 billion. Although this time, despite being up, Wall Street said they missed targets and so ding the stock price.
Yeah, we've seen Intel have a number of different problems. We've talked about the failure to meet the 10 nanometer goals that they've talked things. Desktop chips were delayed. However, the good news is that the desktop sales are starting to recover. And the general consensus seems to be that Intel has been able to exploit its customer relationships and its pricing power. In other words, which is Wall Street speak for raise the prices to the same products. And we've seen that plenty in enterprise IT, certainly part of the software-defined transition in enterprise IT. I think I read a research report this week which suggested that across the board, the IT vendors have managed to increase their prices by 25% by software defining or hyperconverging. So,
not a bad trick
if you can get away with it. So, obviously, enterprise IT customers are not being very smart at the moment, but that's okay. They seem to have the money, so who am I to judge?
Yeah, you mentioned PCs. The PC division brought in $8.7 billion for the quarter, which is up 6% year over year, which may reflect a story we covered last week about PC shipments actually increasing for the first time in like 6 years.
Yay for laptops and desktops. I would actually think it's laptops. I don't think it's desktops. I find that very hard to believe. But then again.
And the data center business, which sells into large cloud companies and the data center, was up 27% year over year on $5.5 billion in revenue. So not bad.
Yeah. That's the one where they've been selling their existing chips for quite higher prices. I'm certainly quite heard a lot about that.
Yeah. All right. Our last story for today, Infinera, they make optical networking gear. They are acquiring Coriant for $430 million. The acquisition is meant to bolster Infinera's ability to compete with market leaders like Ciena, Nokia, and Cisco.
Yeah. So Coriant, this is a scale buy. So I was reading a little bit about this. Basically, Infinera isn't quite big enough to dominate the business and they need to scale up their business. The Infinera makes optical components and Coriant is much more of a product type of company, as if I understand it rightly. Both of them are weaker vendors in the optical space, so merging them together gives them a chance to compete on equal footing. The Coriant acquisition should be nicely accretive, as they say on Wall Street. In other words, it comes with as soon as Coriant is inside Infinera, it should start to cut costs because they share that human resources and executive teams. But also because the products are complementary, they should be able to leverage Infinera's market and get out there.
Very good. All right, well, that wraps up this marathon episode. Greg, where can folks get more from you if they haven't gotten enough already?
You can find me tweetering away this week at Ethereal Mind on the Twitter, but mostly I'll be blogging over at packetpushers.net. I am sadly phasing out the Ethereal Mind blog in favor of pushing all my content onto Packet Pushers. So you can find me in just one place. So get your RSS reader out and subscribe to the blogs or the archives so that you can actually see all our news. We actually have an RSS feed just for blogs and news. So Drew writes a lot of news pieces during the week and I'm blogging fairly regularly during the week. And if you're not seeing that, get your RSS reader out and point it at packetpushers.net.
All right. And as Greg mentioned, I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM and I do blog at packetpushers.net. Thanks to our sponsor, Interoptic, and thank you, of course, for joining us for yet another episode. If you like the show, please tell a friend or leave a recommendation on iTunes. The word of mouth really helps grow the show. And again, check out our membership program. That's at ignition.packetpushers.net. There's free and paid membership options, and the free tier also includes Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. Thanks for listening.